Good afternoon and welcome to this press briefing by two special rapporteurs of the United Nations, Mr. François Crépeau, sitting on the left-hand side. He's the special rapporteur on the human rights of migrants, and Mr. Francisco Carrion Mena is the chair of the Committee on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers and Members of Their Families. We'll start with short remarks by both, and starting with Mr. Carrion Mena. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for coming. We have a crowd here. But, there's a paradox. Migration is in the top of the agenda all over the world. And at the same time, my convention, our convention, the convention, the CMW, from which there's a committee and I'm the chair, is usually the poor brother of the different committees. But that's the paradox. We are talking all days by different ways about migration because of the different conflicts all around the world. And at the same time, there is not enough countries that have ratified the convention. But, well, I must say that migration is a very important and economic and social phenomenon with over 230 million international migrants worldwide. Almost 50% are women. But finally, and that's the most important thing, rather than the economic and social importance, is that they are human beings and they have to be treated as they are. We in the committee have different issues, and we work, I think, a lot, and we are doing well, although we are only 47 state parties. We hope that next year that we are celebrating our 25th anniversary of the signature of the convention, we will have more. But what is really a pity is that we don't have developed and receiving countries as member parties, although they have very advanced national legislation on human rights of workers. That's sort of also a paradox or a contradiction. Why not ratify the convention if they already have in their own internal legislation the sufficient rights accepted and consecrated? Well, we are very concerned, and we work on the exploitation and xenophobia that the migration phenomenon creates all over the world. The way in which irregular migrants are being detained. We work also on the criminalization of irregular migration and that the xenophobia that it creates when they are passing through on borders. I also stress about the importance of the contributions that migrant workers do to the receiving country or the host country, and at the same time to their own country through the remittances and they send back home. There is a very crucial, I would say, issue of migration in borders. That's one also of the issues that we are dealing in the committee. And always I stress the importance of the civil society and the private sector to work with us, with the whole international community, on defending the migrant workers and their families' human rights. Well, it's more useful, I think, if we can talk about these issues with question and answers, but that's what I wanted to stress for the beginning of this press conference.
Thank you, Mr. Karen Mena. And now, Mr. François Crépeau, for your opening remarks.
Thank you very much. My report bears on the integration of migrants and the human rights of migrants in the Sustainable Development Goals and Sustainable Development Agenda as a whole, goals, targets, and indicators. We know and we all recognize that migrants are drivers, enablers of development, that thanks to migrants, the efforts to attain the Millennium Development Goals have been helped through boosting household income, resulting in improved health, greater school enrollment, increasing domestic demand for goods and services, etc., etc. The second element that I want to start with is that large-scale migration is inevitable. This is something which is clear today. It will happen. It will happen in part because it's necessary for growth. It's necessary for the development of a globalized economy. And it's also necessary in the heads of those migrants who want to move, who want to improve their lives, have safer lives, have better lives. Unfortunately, migration at present comes very often at a human cost, especially for the migrants themselves, and especially for the migrants who are in the most vulnerable of situations, irregular migrants in particular, and migrants with a precarious work contract, like sponsored work contracts. And so for all these reasons, there's very little doubt in the heads of most that migrants, that migration has to be included in the post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda. Development is no longer only defined through the economy. Sustainable development includes economic, environmental, social dimensions, and migration touches upon all of this. So if migration is to be integrated into the SDG agenda, we have to go beyond what is talked most about by states, which is the cost of remittances and the cost of labor. We have to include the human cost of migration. And especially we have to include the lives of the most marginalized and the most exploited migrants, those who are, and there's a series of conditions which may be cumulative, such as being in an irregular situation, having a precarious labor contract, being considered low-skilled, being a child or an adolescent, being a woman, especially if you're in domestic work, working in the construction, the hospitality, the extraction, the fishing, the agricultural sector of the economy. All these are factors of precariousness. So national development plans must acknowledge, one, the positive role that migration plays in development, and it must spur migration policies that go beyond implementing security controls, curbing irregular migration, and boosting remittances. We have to take the whole of the lives of those migrants into account, and especially when devising international, regional, or bilateral cooperation or dialogue on migration. We have to consider that migrants are first and foremost human beings, just like any one of us, who are rights holders, like any one of us, exercising their personal freedom to move, and whose dignity, like ours, can be defined by how much they're allowed to exercise options in defining their own future and that of their family, without being only constrained by status and circumstances. We're all constrained in many ways, but we also make moral choices when we can. migrants, and especially migrants in a precarious situation, have very little control over the decisions that are made for them. Facilitating mobility is, to me, the goal, the long-term, mid-term goal is facilitating mobility for everyone, including for low-wage migrants. And so in the report, I make recommendations on how to mainstream migrants and migrants' rights in the Sustainable Development Agenda, how to use the principles of non-discrimination, participation, accountability, access to remedies, etc., at all levels, the goals, the targets, and the indicators. And I stress, in particular, at the end of the report, the importance of collecting reliable and comparable data on migrants, which is not easy to do, especially for the migrants who are in a precarious situation, irregular migrants and migrants with a temporary work contract, who are very often not or badly accounted for in statistics. And for that, we need to count on the participation of hard-to-count migrant populations, such as short-term, circular, irregular, child migrants, trafficked persons, refugees, asylum seekers. All these people who are hard to count have to participate in the design of the surveys, in data and collection instruments, in the dissemination of the data, and in the analysis of the data. It must not be what it is too often on migration. We make migration policies about migrants, but never with them. If we take the slogan of people with disabilities, nothing about us without us, well, this is something that applies to migrants as well, and migrants can use that slogan as well. Migration policies are always about them, but never with them. Well, in the data collection, we have here an opportunity to work with them to make them appear in those statistics and make sure that those statistics are taken into account in the design of policies. And especially when we are devising data collection mechanisms for measuring development and development progress, well, we will need to understand that registering progress requires movement in the reduction of gaps between the most favored parts of the population and the most precarious parts of the population. And progress should also be conditional upon demonstration of progress for the lowest quintiles. That will include many migrants, but not only migrants. In conclusion, states have committed themselves to upholding human rights in many treaties, and the implementation of such commitments is now what is required for setting development priorities. How migration is governed, and that includes the right to move, to live, to work, to seek redress, to participate, how this migration is governed will contribute to determining the kind of development outcomes that can be achieved. And if we don't take that into account, the development outcomes will be off balance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crippo. Maybe we'll take a few questions. Yes, Matthew.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Matthew Lee, Intercity Press, on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access. Thanks for the briefing. There's just been a lot of Ukraine and other news. But I wanted to ask you about I guess they're country specific, but if you want to take it sort of broader, one is the kind of high profile problem of migrant workers in Qatar. It got a lot of coverage building up for the World Cup. And I just wonder, do you think that are improvements being made? What leverage, I guess you could say, does the international community have? Given Qatar was just elected to the Human Rights Council last week. And I wondered if what you can say about that. Also, the question of Australia and the treatment of asylum seekers, whom Australia then tries to say are just economic refugees, who I guess would be another way to say migrant or prospective migrant. What's the trend on this of countries really trying to basically not accept anyone and outsource them to places like Christmas Island? And the same thing is just if in case it rings any bells, the Rohingya, they seem to be at sea trying to go to various places. I'm not sure if you'd consider them kind of refugees from bad treatment or job seekers, but what can you say about that? Thanks a lot.
Who is that addressed to? Qatar? Okay. Qatar. I've done a mission to Qatar a year and a half ago. A year ago. Yeah, a year. Not quite a year ago. Qatar is an interesting place. It has a huge migrant population. 87% of the population of the country is migrant. And it has placed itself in an awkward position. It has accepted the World Cup in 2022. That's 8 years from now. 8 years is very long in politics. And already the spotlights of international media are on Qatar, The Guardian in particular, not to name it, and are telling the world that Qatar does not protect adequately the rights of its migrant workers. What I have encountered in Qatar are severe violations of human rights. It's all documented in my report. Of the human rights of migrants, migrant workers in this case, detention, etc. There's a list of human rights violations. There is a potential silver lining because Qatar has to deliver on the World Cup. And the spotlight is certainly annoying for those who care for the reputation of Qatar. And I could sense that there was a preoccupation with that. And there was a political will to do something. And certainly when I met with what is called Q22, which is the Committee for the Preparation of the World Cup, there was very much an interest that the World Cup work sites, construction sites, those dedicated to constructing the stadiums and the other buildings, would be rid of violations of human rights for the workforce. And so, although none of those construction sites had started when I was there, the plan was to, first of all, adopt a charter for the well-being of migrant workers, which I have seen copies is quite a good document. Implementation remains to be seen, but at least the basic document is good. And second, they wanted to establish a mechanism of auditing at all levels of employment, going down to the lowest level of subcontracting, which would be a way of ensuring that every employer in the system would be monitored and that those migrants would have a voice. Now, there are many. That plan can absolutely go right. Certainly Qatar has the money to put it in place, and so we could see quite interesting results. It could also go awry if the auditing, for example, forgets to interview the migrant workers themselves and relies on documents which would be given by the contractors, etc. So there are plenty of ways in which it could go well, plenty of ways in which it could go awry. So we'll have to see over the years. But certainly I felt that there was concern, a preoccupation, and that there was some level of political will at changing things for those work sites. Now, it was not said in so many words, but whether this could be an experiment that could be then enlarged to the rest of the Qatari economy during the course of the preparation or after the World Cup remains to be seen. So there was an interest there. What other questions did you ask? Australia. Do you want to talk about Australia?
No.
I'll talk about Australia a little bit. Australia has what I think is a problem in terms of human rights. Australia does not have constitutional protection of human rights, contrary to most other global north countries. There's no Australian Charter of Human Rights protecting everyone within the authority's jurisdiction. There is traditional constitutional protection of a number of rights under traditional British constitutional law, but that's not modern international human rights law. Now, it guarantees things as due process more than anything else. Now, so that's a problem. I say it's a problem. because it means that parliamentary sovereignty, as the fundamental principle of British constitutional law, is applicable, and that as long as Parliament votes something and says something clearly, whether it would be condemned under international human rights law doesn't matter, it becomes law. When in countries where you have constitutional human rights guarantees, like Canada, like Europe generally, whether it is constitutional or regional under the European Convention of Human Rights or the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, you know, it's kind of constitutional European law, if you wish. If you have human rights guarantees in place, everyone can access them, including migrants. The tragedy in Australia is that at present, migrants have absolutely no recourse, even when the government takes positions or adopts policies that are manifestly violating international human rights law. And Australia, in that sense, is suffering from a human rights deficit, which is quite extraordinary. At the same time, the experiment that Australia is making in devising ever more creative ways of preventing migrants to reach its territory is looked at with great interest by the rest of the global north, you know, because they would like to see whether what Australia does is applicable to them and whether they could politically import that, which is, I think, also problematic. I'm very much concerned by the fact that the position of Australia today is shared by both the government party and the opposition, and that it's a very there's very much a consensus on how to deal with migrants. A consensus that you also find, for example, in Britain, where the Labour Party and the Conservatives have had similar policies, that you find in France, where the present socialist government and the previous Sarkozy government have similar positions on migration as well. So it's not new. And one of the reasons for that is that there's absolutely no electoral benefit in protecting the rights of migrants, and there's lots of electoral damage that can be done if you start talking about protecting migrants' rights. And so electoral advisors, strategic advisors to all political parties in such a case will be either you say what's going to help us win the next election or you shut up, and this is what's happening in many countries. The fact that migrants live, that a huge number of migrants live in our countries, work, pay taxes in everything they buy or rent anyway, even when they are irregular migrants, while being unrepresented, is a structural defect, a structural flaw of our democracies. We have long-term population living under the law, paying taxes, contributing to society, and they have no say in all the laws that are applicable to them. And this is an issue that all of our countries will have to deal with for the decades to come. Some countries, by allowing, for example, voting rights at local level or at regional level, are already starting to tackle this. And certainly cities in many countries have been at the forefront of protecting the rights of all their community, including migrants, including irregular migrants, because these people are part of the community whether or not we want it. They are part of the community. They work here, they live here, their kids go to school, they are sick here, everything. They're part of who we are. So this is going to be a problem for a long time, and we will have to tackle that. It's not because migrants come irregularly or come regularly and then overstay a visa or come with a very precarious temporary working permit, that anything goes and that whatever we want to do to them should be allowed to be done. That's not how human rights work. The last question was?
Rohingya.
Yeah, to me the Rohingya case is a very clear case of refugees. This is a minority. It's a persecuted minority, an unrecognized minority, which is even worse. And unfortunately, there's little appetite for any country in the region to actually welcome them and protect them. And so we need a lot more focus on their fate. We need to collectively act and to collectively, first of all, pressure the home country, Myanmar in particular, to protect them better and to recognize them as one of the minorities of Myanmar. And second, we need to make pressure on many more countries to accept contingents of Rohingya refugees as part of the of their refugee resettlement programs. I think to expand a little bit on this idea, I'm very concerned by the fact that there's so little appetite in the world today for resettling refugees. Countries like Turkey, like Jordan, like Lebanon have been shouldering millions of refugees from Syria. Tunisia has shouldered almost 1 million refugees from Libya a few years ago. And there is little appetite, especially in the global north, for resettling these people who have fled a bloody civil war and to recognizing them as refugees. Which situation? Letting refugee camps in the neighboring countries fester for a number of years, which leads to irregular population movements and leads to the securitization and criminalization of irregular migration from Syrians, when we all know that Syrians cannot go home and are facing a horrible fate if they go back home. So as long as there will not be a real effort, a major effort for resettling Syrian refugees, but also Libyan refugees and Eritrean refugees and Iraqi refugees, an effort that would be comparable to the one that was made for Indochinese, for the Indochinese in the late 70s, early 80s, we are going to see an increase in irregular movements of population, and we're going to see probably a radicalization of the anti-immigration sentiment in many countries in the global north. And I hope that this is not a strategy. I hope that this is simply short-sightedness. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kripo.
I want only to say that you have mentioned two cases in which the committee, migrant workers, cannot do nothing because these countries are not members of the convention. That's why I have nothing to say, but it is, I think, imperative to have all countries over the world as being members of the convention. The committee can deal with the situation of Qatar. That doesn't mean that we done within the committee we haven't talked about the situation in Qatar. Mr. Crepeau has quite clearly exposed about what's happening there, and we are very worried. But at the same time, Qatar is not a member of the convention. The same Australia. Australia, well known for a receiving country historically, now is not a member of the convention. And that's why our concern about the need of having as many as possible countries as members, state parties of the convention, so we can deal, we can help, we can explain about what is the convention about. It's not inventing or creating new rights. No, it's just a sort of summarizing the human rights that are already in regional instruments or national legislation, so we can work within the UN, and that's very important. Let me say that I was before, 3 years ago, I was PR of Ecuador here at the UN, and I felt that there was an impotence to do things here because there's no political will. In this case, especially in the migrant issue, it has been so politicized that there's no political will to ratify the convention. The EU, for example, the whole countries. I'm not going to mention any special country, but traditionally, Europe have been countries of asylum, of receiving countries. The U.S. Maybe it's the most clear example about their population now, and that's the problem. They are not willing to become state parties, and I really don't understand, except for political reasons. And I think the committee thinks that, of course, human rights are before or are a priority than other considerations. So that's why I appeal. We are working, our committee is doing, I think, a very good job, but with a very little number of countries, and especially those receiving developed countries that are not members of the convention. There are problems all over the world. In Qatar, you have mentioned, in Syria, in Iraq, even in Ukraine, people are moving. But those countries are not members of the convention. So we need to enforce the presence of the UN as an institution, as an organization, by, I don't know, putting forward our desire, our what we like to have as members of the international community regarding the human rights. That is the essential factor of what we are working on. And, well, I'm not a child. I understand the political issues regarding this whole phenomenon. But if we talk about human rights, we must be part of the system created by the UN to protect the human rights of migrant workers and their families.
Thank you, Mr. Karamena. And maybe one or two last questions, and then we'll get you first, please.
What can you tell us about the rights of migrant workers in Portugal, Scandinavian countries, and the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania? Have these countries modified the convention?
Well, those countries are not members of the convention. I have had a bilateral with the TPR or Norway, and for example, that's a country that has even a more advanced internal legislation regarding the human rights of workers, but they are not, they haven't signed nor ratified the convention, and that's the case for all these Scandinavian countries. And I ask myself, they have received a lot of, if you remember the dictators in Latin America and south of South America, Chile, Uruguay, Argentina, many Latin Americans went to the Scandinavian countries because they received them. But now they are having ratified the convention, so we can do nothing. That's the problem. We, of course, we try to create this ambience of necessity of signing, and we, in that case, we need the press, the media. For example, the case of Qatar has been, especially the Guardian at the UK, is continuing working on that issue, that is really impressed about what is going on. But Qatar is not a member of the convention as these other countries, the Scandinavian countries.
One last question.
One thing I can add to that.
Your microphone.
One thing I can add to this on the issue of why countries don't ratify, and it relates to what I have said earlier.
about the structural flaw in our electoral democracies, that we allow people to be unrepresented for decades. We know that the political debate on migration in most countries in the global north is absolutely toxic. And it's toxic because we have this consensus at top level that fighting irregular migration and, in the words of Mitt Romney, trying to push migrants into self-deportation is actually the best way of gaining votes in the next election. That creates a toxic debate. That toxic debate comes from the fact that the most interested persons to the debate, in that debate, the migrants themselves, have no access to the debate. Women's issues came to the political stage when women got the right to vote and when their vote started to matter for politicians and when they themselves became politicians and they convinced one party to take on women's issues and you know, finally they got to, in some countries, to parity in the executive, etc. They won battles thanks to their voice being uttered loud and clear and heard on the political stage. This is not going to happen for migrants in the foreseeable future. What are we left with? We're left with other methods to have one's voices heard. And that is the courts and tribunals, which have usually no electoral advantage and will often contradict what governments want to do on such issues. And we've seen very good decisions by the Canadian Supreme Court, the Australian Supreme Court, the American Supreme Court, European Court of Human Rights, etc., etc. We're left also with national human rights institutions, which have something to say. Human rights commissions, ombudspersons, etc. They have something to say. Some of them have taken up the immigration issue and have been saying that the government should do a lot better to protect the rights of migrants. They are independent if they respect the principles of Paris. We're left with people, with NGOs who do their best and some lawyers who do pro bono work in favor of migrants and help them. We're also left with all the people who are coming into contact with migrants and who may make a difference in their lives. And that's what I've talked about also in my presentation at the Assembly this morning. The police, the local police, labor inspectors, social workers, healthcare providers, school directors, etc. All these people come into contact with migrants. And they can hear the voice of migrants, and they can make that voice count. The police, for example, just to take a striking example. If the local police is tasked with checking immigration papers, no irregular migrant, and even no migrant in a precarious, legal but precarious work situation, will call the police, even in a case of family violence or if there are gunshots next door. They won't call the police, because they fear the police asking them their immigration paper and doing something, detecting, detaining, deporting. They will not collaborate. The police will not be able to count on the trust of the whole of the community to do its job, which is law and order, not immigration control. So what I suggested this morning is that we have to establish firewalls between public services and immigration enforcement. We need immigration enforcement. That's part of what being sovereign means. But we need also independent public services that are able to complete their mission towards everyone. So this is, to me, an issue which explains why states, even those who are surpassing the minimums that are provided for in that convention, don't want to ratify it. They don't want to ratify it because doing so is a speech act. And tomorrow, the nationalist populist forces in their country will say, vote against that government that is giving rights to migrants, when it's not what they're doing. But since migrants are not part of the debate, since no party is taking the part of the migrants because we have this flaw, it will go uncontradicted in the political debate. And that's what so many of those stereotypes and those fantasies are going uncontradicted. Migrants take jobs. Migrants bring ill health. You know, migrants will bring Ebola these days. Things like that. This goes uncontradicted because there's no political constituency out there. So we need to work on how to give migrants a voice, despite the fact that the convention is not ratified.
Thank you. Maybe one last question, then we have to end, please.
Thank you, Mexican News Agency. There is a large flow of unaccompanied children coming from Central America to the U.S. in the recent months. Do you have any guidelines or suggestions as to how the U.S. government could deal with this phenomenon? And my other question is, many of these kids are along with adults from Central America and Mexico, are sent to court without legal representation. So they cannot file a request for asylum, according to many NGOs. What's your opinion on that? Thank you.
Another case in which one of the parties is not a member of the convention, that is the U.S. Mexico is one of the, is the country that pushed forward the convention initially 25 years ago. So all Central American countries are members of the convention, and we have work a lot with them about this issue. But if in this case the U.S. is not member, we can only do what we have done, a declaration regarding our concern of the situation of these children, demanding or asking for the U.S. government to treat them according to the human rights charter. But we cannot do more than that. But we have highlighted, myself, I have done a lot of declarations, press releases about our concern of what's going on in the U.S.-Mexican border. We have worked, as I said, with the Central American countries. Receive reports about what's going on, because as you know very well, the situation is so dramatic and tragic that comes from from Costa Rica, even through all Central America, and goes to the U.S. border, the Mexican U.S. border, and many people have died in this way, in that way, the how is called the La Bestia, the train of the Bestia, where people are killed in their way to the U.S. border. We have had a lot of concern about that. We have received, for example, a very important and very polemic report from Mexico. Mexico is one of the countries that has this problem and has to deal with this problem, not only with the U.S., but also with Guatemala. So in that case, for example, Guatemala, Mexico, both are members of the convention, when we have work on the reports of both countries, and we can help to deal with that problem. But with the U.S. border, we can do only declarations and wishes, words, papers, that finally it doesn't help enough.
Yes, Mr. Kripo, please.
To answer your question very quickly, migrant children are protected by international human rights law. The United States have not ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but most of what's in the convention is already provided for in many other instruments, human rights instruments that the United States have ratified, and is also provided for in international customary human rights law. And so so the U.S. are bound internationally by those principles. One major principle of international law that has emerged over the past decades is the principle of the best interest of the child.
and many issues have to be seen through that lens. The Committee on the Rights of the Child has said 2 years ago that immigration detention can never be in the best interest of a child. Never, ever, period. So alternatives to detention have to be found. Detention is never the right option. That's something which is quite simple, but in my many country visits for the past 3 years, I've never seen alternatives to detention in immigration detention being properly implemented to benefit most migrants, because detention for adults and children should be a measure of last resort when other options have been exhausted. And we see when we think about criminal detention that this exists. You don't detain preventatively, because that's what we're talking about. We don't detain preventatively someone who is suspected of a criminal act unless the person has been offered to pay bail, bond, having a guarantor, etc., house arrest, curfew. You have many, giving your traveling to your passport to the authorities. There are many ways of ensuring that preventative detention is avoided. And it should always be a measure of last resort and never for children. And children, never for children means never for families, which means that we should find alternatives to detention for them. But that's true for many other issues. Not being represented by a counsel for proceedings, which are complex in law and in fact, can never be in the best interest of the child. Again, not going to school, which we are seeing in many places in the U.S. where these kids have ended up, can never be in their best interest. And yet we see resistance to sending them to school. So here I think there is a clear fault line as to how we should treat these people and how we're treating them in fact. There are major human rights violations at stake here. And I'm saying this under the caveat that I haven't made a country visit to the U.S. And I'm basing myself on what I read in the New York Times and in other media outlets. But the question you asked, based on the series of facts that I think everyone can read about in the newspapers, show that there are human rights issues and clear human rights issues here.
Thank you, Mr. Crippo, and thank you, Mr. Karen Mena. That's all the time we had. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.